Thanks to everyone for coming tonight or joining in on the Zoom or listening to it or watching this broadcast film of it later. So Fred Hilmer makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think probably we remember him best for the work he did here on Strictly Boardroom about 25 years ago. But tonight talking on the topic of his new book, What's Wrong with Boards? Rethinking Corporate Governance. I'll introduce Fred Hilmer very briefly because he's well known. He's held a number of key leadership and governance roles. He was President and Vice Chancellor of the University of New South Wales from 2006 to 2015, having previously served as Chief Executive of John Fairfax Holdings from 1999 to 2005 and many other roles beyond that. But he's here tonight talking on the topic of rethinking corporate governance. Fred, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Darren, and welcome. And on the Zoom, I think there are some houses where our children are located. So hello, children. I'm told by my most adventuresome daughter that they have got a wall TV, popcorn and party type food. And that suggests to me they have no idea what I'm talking about. As Jared said, and I think his numbers weren't quite right, I counted 30 years since we did Strictly Boardroom. It was 92.
Well, I'm not an economist.
And of course, the older you get, the more time is compressed. So it seems like 20 years. This book came together because for a number of reasons. I think one was Byron Perola and Port Jackson quite interested in governance. Could we do something on governance? And people were independently coming to me saying, you wrote Strictly Boardroom. Why don't you bring it up to date? And we, as old friends, got together and tried to work out a way we might, if we were lucky, get a book done. And it's a great thrill. I only saw it a few days ago to actually see the book is done. It will be even better if people read it. And it would be superb if they read it and used it as an opportunity to question some of the practices that we now associate with good governance. Perspective. We wrote this because it's a hard problem. It's not easy to be a good director. It's certainly not easy to chair a company. And the pressures that are on boards are only going one way, and that's up. And in that environment, you keep thinking, is there something, is there a better way? Can there be a better way? Not because people are messing it up, but because doing it is hard and it's getting harder. And I'll come back to some of that sort of pressures that are put upon boards of directors. Three quick ideas by way of introduction. One is the publicly listed company, which is the vehicle through which the board operates, is a key institution. It's really an important source of capital, capital for big things that require scale, but also capital for little things that you hope will blossom. But it's an unusual source of capital because it not only is a source of capital, it's a source of investment opportunities. The term I'd heard someone use was it democratizes investments. But to everyone who is issuing shares, there's someone buying shares. And the share ownership in Australia is quite surprising. It's about 35% of people own shares in listed companies, excluding what they own through their superannuation. So this is something which has quite a long tail and a big impact. It isn't just for the top 0.5% or the top 10%. This is a vehicle that creates investment opportunities and provides capital. And in that sense, it's an important institution. However, you knew that was coming, but there's all is not well in what are called public company land. The public company's had a pretty rough time, you could say, of its own making. But it's been a really rough time. We've had the Royal Commission, which was an extremely thorough piece of work. It raised quite important issues. We've had the Prudential Authority and the Regulatory Authority looking at this, and we've had individual companies looking at themselves. And the prevailing feeling you get out of all that is negative. There's very little in any of those reports that say people are doing a great job. It's this is messed up, that's messed up, shouldn't have done it that way, why didn't you do this? So we're coming into this time when we want to rethink it with a very negative view of what the listed company board does. The other thing that really makes the landscape unattractive at the moment is there are a lot of casualties. I mean, I still have to sort of almost pinch myself when I say all the big four lost chairs, lost CEOs, wealth management firms lost CEOs. We've never seen a turnover like that in leadership position in this country. And that's telling us something that we ignore at our peril. So all is not well in public company land. And we are curious, and what I want to talk about is where that might take us and what we might do. Right. I decided on Jared's good advice not to use a slide. So I apologise when my fingers just don't turn the page. There's another way to look at the issue, and that is look at what the challenges are that the public company boards are trying to deal with. And we broke those into two areas of failure. Failure of performance and ethical and legal failures. And if you think about it, then what are the failures of performance? The most significant, we think, is the acceptance by a board of marginal performance. That's the damned if you do, damned if you don't position. We talk to directors, we've got an MD, the MD is adequate but not exciting. What are we going to do? And if you're damned if you do, if you get rid of the person, there's no guarantee you won't find he wasn't that bad after all. And if you don't get rid of that person, you continue to live with the uncomfortable feeling that, are we really doing our job? Are we really engaging properly in terms of the performance that we expect? The other side of that, the failure of performance, is what we call can-kicking, something in the book, there are a number of examples, but when life gets tough and you see a can on the side of the road, kick it down the road, and if you're lucky, someone else will pick it up. And if you're unlucky, kick it again. But that's a metaphor for what I think is an important area of performance that gets away from the board, and then it becomes too hard. The other side of the ethical and legal failures, and I think the Royal Commission, Justice Hayne, really did quite a good job and quite an elegant job in terms of defining what that was. But in simplest terms, and it goes beyond boards, we have to draw a distinction between what I can do and what I should do. And when we mix that up, we get into trouble. And particularly when what I can do allows me to enrich myself and what I should do is not do that, you get the sort of tension that characterised the Royal Commission. So we've got the public company land, as we said, getting some tough reviews, making some big changes in terms of personnel, not all of which were applauded, and trying to deal with some ethical challenges and performance challenges that, after all, is what the public company is there for. How does the public company work? And it seemed to me that not much has changed since we did Strictly Boardroom in 92, and which was also the year that Sir Adrian Cadbury came out with the Cadbury Report, which is the blueprint for the way in which governance is dealt with. There were four bits to Cadbury. The first was independence of directors, really important to him. If you didn't have directors whose sole and obsessive interest was in the welfare of the company, you were going to have trouble with the governance regime. So independence was really important. His second was independent non-executive chair. That's more controversial, and I'll come back to it. The third was transparent, accurate, and relevant disclosures. If you don't know what's going on, and I think, again, these commissions and reviews have shown that if you don't know what's going on, you can't do anything about it. And keeping properly informed and having management form and the chair of the board driving full and accurate disclosure is the third category principle. The fourth was to have supportive processes, committees, risk and REM and audit, and to have people involved in those committees who were going to do a good job, whether they were or weren't on the board. So that's where Cadbury was, and I don't think that much has changed. We can pick it up in questions, but the basic idea of independence, listing rules still don't like non-executive chairs, information being seen as really critical, and structure of the boards being something that we can be, I think, smarter about. So that suggests not a lot of change in terms of how we do governance, but that is absolutely misleading. What has changed is, firstly, the boards are being asked to take on significant new roles: ESG, employment implications, ethics, values, diversity, sense of purpose. Any one of those can become a topic that requires work and debate, and if it's there, the ability to take advantage of an opportunity. So there are new roles, but at the same time, the traditional role of providing good governance, the traditional roles become more difficult. I mean, one of the things we looked at was some of the big corporations 20 years ago and now, and it's the same governance, but it's not the same company. And we see complexity not just through size, but also through the challenges that they have to field. The disruptors who are coming in and would say, I think we've got a better way to do what you do. How do you then deal with that? So what the other sort of side to what has changed is we had a very simple plan with Cadbury, but it was oversimplified. And it wasn't supported by research. And that's where, for example, the non-executive chairman desire, which all listing rules, New York would like to have it, we would like to have it. But the reality is, when you have an executive chair, you've pretty much got a founder. And when you've got a founder, the reality is, there's a nice quote, I can't remember who I took it from, even at a round table, someone sits at the head. So when you've got a founder with controlling or potentially controlling shareholders, when you've got a founder who knows the business and who grows the business, who lives the business, then the idea that there's going to be a non-executive over that person and over that process makes no sense. And the research, in fact, tells you that the founder shareholder restricting sort of that idea and not having a founder shareholder but having a non-executive shareholder will lead to worse results. We're not having a non-executive chair because things are going to get better. We're having it because it satisfies some tenet of good governance that may or may not be applicable. The other thing that has changed or has come onto the scene is this word best practice. Let's see if I can find it. You know, when you sit and play around with your computer, you at times come up with gems. And I just put in best practice and I thought, what's going to come up? And I found that Professor Kuban, who is at Stanford in the education school, was similarly perplexed as to what is this thing called best practice. And I quoted it, it's on page 76, but you don't need to. Where does the phrase best practice originate? I checked around the blogosphere, and its origin seems to be in the business sector with management consultants and corporate gurus. It's become a buzzword. In becoming popular, the phrase has drifted away linguistically from its original meaning of effective practices in accomplishing goals to mean faddish or trendy activities. And if that's another side of governance, we have an answer, it should be this. And I'll come back to some examples of that. The result of best practice is that people who believe in it believe there is only one way to run a company. That's the best practice way. There's only one way to structure a board. Reality in management theory, that idea has been discredited over 50 years ago, that we don't. There is no one best way. What is the best way is contingent upon the circumstances you deal with. So rather than best practice, we would prefer, and in the book advocate, best fit. Because fit, best fit says, what does this company or board need to do in light of who it is, who its competitors are, what's happening with regulation, what's happening with our people and our willingness and ability to implement. And so what has changed, hopefully, is not there is increasing complexity. There's increasing complexity in terms of the companies. But we have an opportunity to simplify things if we could get rid of some of the non-research supported ideas. High on the list is best practice. I'll take three case studies that I think make that point more graphically. The first one I take is the skills matrix. Who familiar with the skills matrix? Are you embarrassed that you do one? No. The skills matrix has a really interesting genesis. I need to cheat because I get the dates wrong. But in 2003, there was no skills matrix. The editions of the ASX guidelines didn't mention skills matrix. 2007 came for the next revision. Silence. Not a word about skills matrix. Then in 2010, the third edition saw the introduction of a skills matrix as a formal recommendation, requiring the companies have one and disclose it. And that became something that companies had to do and put into their annual reports. Annual reports have a skills matrix. 19 now, so we're now at 2019, and the Governance Institute is picking the ball up here and is writing quite a lengthy paper on the skills matrix. But there's just, it's all assertion. One of the phrases, having a skills matrix is good governance. Why? And then when you think about what a skill matrix, I mean, what company in their right mind is going to lay out skills in a way that is obviously transparent and shows their competitor exactly where they ought to hit? I mean, who would do that? Only someone who believes in best practice. So skills matrix, I thought it's a wonderful example. Yeah. The other good example, I think, is, and it's important, independence is an interesting and important concept. We define it in the listing rules very mechanistically. Have you had some sort of financial interest with the company that would in some way influence your ability to be objective and single-minded about performance? But going along with that is the belief that more is better. So if you have seven non-executives, directors, then you should have seven who stay independent and none who are not independent. The more is better. Well, again, if you look at certainly the research in the United States, not true. More isn't better. You get all the benefit of an independence as long as there's at least a simple majority. So why do we do this in terms of independence? Think more is better. That's not the point. The point is, if It's not a numbers game. Having a majority is useful, but what are you actually going to expect them to do, and how are you going to assess independence? Because the independence that matters is not whether you were on the audit team 3 years ago, but the independence that matters is, have you got independence of mind and the experience and the nose, the noise and knows, the experience and the nose to make judgments about the veracity of people, about the skills that they're bringing to bear, and about their ability to function as a member of a body like a board. So independence in practice is nothing like independence in the listing rules, but it's not trivial, and I think it's an area where quite a bit more work is needed to find better ways to gauge independence and to make that judgment. On the last example is founder-led companies. I think I've covered that adequately. So what do we do? Where did we come? The last three chapters deal with some ideas for getting out of these various traps that have emerged along the way. The first is to think about how you might structure a board, how you might structure governance. We are at the moment still stuck in this, there's one way and it's the ASX way. But if you look not too far around Western countries in particular, but also Europe, there are at least five models, and I think maybe seven, of what could be a best fit approach to governance that should be considered. So the first is the ASX board. And we're not saying that's a hopeless model. It's a model that works in certain circumstances. It works when the business can be readily understood. It works when you've got a competitive market, and it works when your market is relatively stable. And under those conditions, this sort of a board works reasonably well. When times get more complex and tougher, you need more input. In the ASX board, the premium is on independence. When you move away from an ASX board to what we call an industry-heavy board, in an industry-heavy board, the premium is on knowledge. You're trying to recruit people to the board who, in addition, have independence of mind, but who have knowledge that can contribute and that isn't easily obtained and used. So you have an executive-heavy board. The executives might be the chair, that's one version of it, So it could be the chair, it could be retiring executives who have more to contribute but can do that more effectively as a director, and it might be experts that you want to bring on the board. But all of those are ways in which you supplement independence with knowledge rather than independence is king, queen and the whole kingdom. Then there's another board that exists around here and we see it increasing, and that's the private equity board. And you know, that is a real challenge, because a private equity board is about improvement. That's why they buy in, and they buy in to sell out, and in the process have to add value and improve. And you can look at that board, which is probably not able to be constructed in accordance with ASX guidelines, but it's a board that offers something economically that other boards don't, and how do you want to deal with it? Then there's two others I want to talk about briefly. One is what's called governance 3.0. And this has come out of the US, and it's intriguing but probably impractical. But the idea, if you think about it, is you've got a management team and they are 24/7 on the business and they know this stuff. And you've got you've got directors, particularly independent directors, who maybe do 250 hours a year on their director activities, and some of whom do less, and many of whom have important other roles, the chairman of something else or managing director somewhere else. Governance 3.0 says, what about having two of your directors as full-time members supporting the governance activities of the rest of the board? And I think it's an intriguing idea. No one's implemented it yet. But again, if we're coming to this task as something where we want to make improvements and we want to think differently to do that, then Governance 3.0 might have something in it. Particularly when you look at some of the struggles and the failures of an audit process, having a full-time experienced person supporting the non-executives might make a lot of sense. And lastly, and I won't belabor it, is the two-tier board. That's very much the German or the European model. You have a supervisory board, which deals much more with compliance, and then you have a management board, which deals much more with running the business. And the two work hand in hand. A lot of people thought this was really good and it would avoid the problems that exist with a single board. Graham Bradley, I know, wrote a paper where he said, by the way, they've had the same problems in Europe. And now, just in the last few weeks, we've seen a similar sort of problem in Japan with Toyota. So, first one is look at your structures and have an open mind about board structures that could work. The second is, how do you deal with the broadening agenda? I mean, you can't just take more time for board meetings. Board meetings are already taking much longer than they did. You know, when I started, it was lunch and 2 o'clock meeting, or 11 to 1 meeting and lunch. And
best practice.
Thank you.
Would be today.
Yeah. So we need some sort of forcing device to use time better. And we, in the next chapter in the book, we talk about focus and delegation. We talk about focus and delegation as partners, not one or the other. If you focus without delegation, you blow up. That's sort of what's happening. And if you delegate without focus, you abdicate. And you need to find the right balance between the complementary ideas, the right balance between focus and delegation. The final thing I wanted to talk about was leadership. That is particularly the leadership of the chair of the board. We did a lot of informal discussion with people about what were the issues in governance. And out of that, and I won't call this a rigorous survey that will get me an academic prize, but it was clear that the way in which the chair was selected, the leadership role that the chair undertook, and the type of partnerships between the CEO and chair that were so critical were all areas where you could improve performance. And so our third suggestion is pick that up. So in summary, I've got two contrasts that I think capture what I've been trying to say. And that is, the first one is, think about best fit, not best practice. And the second is, be evidence-based, not belief-based. And if we bring that hard thinking to what is a difficult to structure, messy but important problem, then I'm optimistic we can start to move forward here. And in the next 30 years, someone, but not me, will come up with the next version of this 30-year Sydney Institute series.
Okay. We'll all be here.
We'll all be here. So thank you. And that.
You want a bit more water? Yeah. So thanks for that. Fred Hill spoiled all this a bit because Normally, best practice is you ask questions and make comments and be brief, but so now we've got to call it best fit. So we're into best fit. So I should say we have copies. I mean, it's just been hot off the press. Fred Hilmer's What's Wrong with Boards? Rethinking Corporate Governance. And Fred will sign copies tonight. Also, Anne will be selling them on our website so people can buy them from our website, signed copies by Fred Hilmer. So we come to questions and discussion. So if you just come back up here and we'll be on our way. As you know, you wrote a book about your time at John Fairfax Holdings Limited, and you wrote, I think from memory, it was called What I Didn't Learn from the Management Books. Did you learn anything from the management books?
What? That's a hard question.
Talk
to the back of the room.
The management texts are a very good source of ideas and provocations and examples that you might build off. And I think a lot of them are not rigorous in the way an academic text is rigorous, but they provide a lot of stories. And a lot of management is around stories, around creating narratives, creating a sense of where we're going, a sense of belonging. And I think the management books understand that probably better than the maths-based microeconomic approach to strategy.
And has anyone read your management books? I mean, there was an interjection here about your own management books.
I don't know if we can fit in a cab. But I'll give you an incentive for this management book. What we've agreed is once we've covered the costs of doing it, the royalties from this book will go to the university, to the Australian Graduate School of Management. So hopefully we'll produce somebody in time out of this book that will write a management book, Gerard, that you love.
We'd love to more of them if the money went to the Sydney Institute, but there you go. Okay, so where are we up to? Is a question, Graham? I just pass it in there.
Thanks. Can you hear that? Thanks, Fred, for a very thoughtful book and a terrifically important topic.
Just speak up a bit.
Is that not working?
It's working.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Fred, for a thoughtful book and a terrifically important topic, which, as a practicing director and chairman, I fully relate to the complexity that's being imposed now on public companies, directors in particular, and the scrutiny that comes about it. But as someone who was involved intimately in the development of the 2003 ASX Corporate Governance Guide Principles and Guidelines and subsequent amendments to them, I wonder if the problem isn't so much the principles, which you, of course, use the language of rules, which, as you know, it's about disclose if not, why not disclosure rather than rigid rules. They're intended to avoid the American Sarbanes-Oxley rigid black letter law governance principles, which would have made things even worse, I'm sure, in your view. And I wonder if the problem hasn't been so much the companies themselves that have been weak-kneed in taking best fit to the market and to their shareholders against the pressures of proxy advisors rather than the rules themselves.
Yeah, I agree, Graham, that there's more flexibility that could be used if you were committed to it. But there's another side to it, which is that if you do your if not why not means I don't comply with the listing rules, but this is the reason and we think it's a good reason. If you do that and then something goes wrong, you didn't follow best practice. Well, we did if not, why not? Well, you got it wrong. And the liabilities of directors are real. They're probably exaggerated, but they're real. So you got caution building up. You got to be brave. And if you get it wrong, you may pay for the mistake. So I think getting out of it, that's why I say it's a hard topic. But I think there are some examples that are quite... I think executive-heavy boards exist. We should just be more open about them. And, I mean, 3.0, I'm not proposing. I've said it's it's a way to think. There might be aspects of a 3.0 board that would work.
Thanks, Fred. Following on your comments about director liability, obviously the Corporations Act contains a number of directors' duties, and I wondered what your view is as to whether those duties or what effect they have on director behaviour, and do you think that those provisions go some way to protect shareholders?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think a lot of the processes that we have are designed to protect directors from liability. So if we had a meeting, as we're supposed to meet every 3 months, we had the meeting, we not minuted it, it was attended well, so we've done our job. And this shift to process is I think the bit of your question that worries me more.
There's a question down there.
Thank you, Fred, for a fascinating talk. I was wondering whether you could comment on, I wonder whether some of the difficulties that boards are having with increased talk of things like stakeholder capitalism and ESG, there's a sort of expanding scope for what businesses should be engaged in that makes some of that difficult. And I'm wondering, one particular aspect which I'm wondering whether you can comment on is the increasing tendency for large companies to embrace social and political issues, often quite controversial ones. In Australia, it might be issues of like constitutional recognition, but in the past, it was things like same-sex marriage. And in the States, there's obviously examples of post-Dobbs decision in the Supreme Court or Black Lives Matters. I'm wondering, at the board level, do you think that boards are sufficiently capable or are actually working through how they think their company stands on these positions? Or is it the sort of CEO adopting a position? I'm just wondering what the maturity level of boards are in thinking in advance and both in response to these issues when they happen.
Yeah. I think it varies. But I think if you are on a board, and you, even if your prime interest is the success of the entity, then you probably ignore certain social issues at your peril. And it's a question of through what lens you see the issue. Am I seeing this as an issue because I think that's a better way for the world to operate? Or am I seeing this as an issue because it will make sense to a number of our stakeholders and employees, and the cost of what we're doing is not generally prohibitive? I mean, some of the criticism, I think I've included it, but I wouldn't. Some of the criticisms of the stakeholder capitalism is it's actually unworkable. And companies are just being cynical because the promise costs you nothing. So you've got to be careful. But I think if you look at this through the lens of I'm responsible for the long-term well-being of this company, you see the social issue, I think, in a more sensible light.
I've found sometimes that those who want to be on boards, sometimes as many as possible, are the very people one doesn't want on a board. Those who you have to sort of persuade to go on, they've got a lot of experience and expertise, they're the people you want. So could you comment on this tendency to have, you know, people make a career out of being on boards?
Yeah, that's something that's become more prevalent, the career director. And we do talk about it. And the first place we talk about it is when we look at independence. If you're a director who relies on being on three boards for a living, I'm now a professional director, and for whatever reason you irritate your colleagues or the chairman feels you're not appropriately on the board, and you go off the board, you may not get other boards. And then you're really stuck because you've given up your professional career. So I think there's independence issues in what you say that to me are quite important issues. What was the other part? There was two parts to your question.
Well, just whether it's positive to have so many people who want to become professional board members. or professional directors?
Yeah, I think the market will sort that out. That, I mean, anyone can be whatever they want to be if they are good enough to get the job. And there are people we might look at and say, I can't believe that person got appointed to that board. But they did, and there are processes, and maybe they don't get re-elected. Maybe the chair has a quiet word with them. But it is, that last point I finished on, the importance of the role of the chair, sorting out who should be on the board and who's now run out of time is a really important responsibility.
Question here.
Thanks, Fred. Incredibly refreshing for somebody who was a founder.
Speak into the...
Sorry. Retired at 30 and then came back to try and serve other organisations. Spent 10 years at the top end of town. Made a decision that I would not work with lawyers nor ASX-listed companies. and has joined Graham on the board of Shine Justice, just to prove that that was a stupid thing to do. But, you know, culture, strategy and value, in my view, and the power of founders who have a very long-term commitment, yet to the good of the business, seems to be completely overlooked and completely undervalued. So, you know, my question for you is, how and why would this change, based on the institutionalisation, which is what it feels like to me, of the corporate governance principles?
Sorry, how would what change? How
would why would it change? What would be the stimulus that would see the outcomes that you talk about and that long-term passion for the greater good of the organisation emerge?
Yeah, ultimately, the stimulus has to come from the demonstrated performance. This is a better way to do things. And to the extent there's a chink in the armour of the founder shareholder, we should find better ways to deal with it. And they are sort of I've been a lead independent director under Frank Lowy, so that's as good a test as I want in my short life. Most of the time, the market system works. I'm a strong market believer. Most of the time, the market system works. It just is bumpy sometimes along the way. And sorting out of people who are inappropriate or directions that are inappropriate. There are enough people who say, if you keep going with it and you're running the place down, I wouldn't mind buying you.
Yes.
Question here.
Professor Hilmer, thanks for your presentation. I was actually at ASX when the Corporate Governance Council initiative was started. It was a response from the government to both HIH and Enron. They basically told ASX, you fix it or we will. Over time, it has gotten, as you observe, more onerous and more rigorous, as is the bias for action. Do you see a world where the capital markets will essentially fragment into public and private, and where the quality investments are kept away from public markets, and there is a social cost to that as well, from this fact, because a lot of companies are avoiding the public markets because of the onerous obligations of corporate governance, disclosure, ASIC, regulation, and the rest.
Well, it's maybe a wishful dream, but we would hope that one of the byproducts of the work that has been put together will get people to think about that issue. It's happening now at Sydney Airport, maybe AGL. Companies are moving across. I can't recall the exact statistics, but I think in the UK and in the US, the growth of the public markets is total growth. There's been no growth in the private market. Sorry, other way around. No growth in the public markets, all growth in the private markets. Again, it'll come back to what's the best way to make a return. But I think there are enough people with enough interest in the public market that maybe they can pick up some of the noise that is, you don't have to be a genius to hear, and start to work on which of the restrictions that I, some of which I covered briefly today, which of those things are real, which of those things are costly, and which of those things could we do without? And if you're thinking of one and want to start, the Matrix.
Question down the back. I'd like to ask a specific question about the share buybacks and dividend. I mean, when companies make money, they like to reward the shareholders. And in America, companies tend to use the buybacks. But in Australia, like traditionally, we pay high dividends. But recently, we also start to using buybacks. So could you share with us, when you're working for the boarders, and how you decide, how you balance, you know, whether you should using share buybacks or pay more dividends? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that. I mean, I think, well, we were not really looking so much at the way corporations use their balance sheets and their earnings to reward their shareholders. And I'm not, that's not an area of expertise that I feel comfortable saying a lot about. So I have to duck that one.
Early on, you made some comments about the Hayne Royal Commission. You focus on the negative aspects. Were there too many negative aspects? I mean, if you were looking at it from outside, you would get the impression that much of Australian companies were badly run. Whereas compared with other nations, that's probably not the case. So do you think there's too much negativity, or was it important to make those points the way they were made?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of inertia here. And, you know, a lot can be done without necessarily changing the law. And I actually don't think Hayne was too negative. I think you had no one... Everyone's very good at glossing over negatives. We're really good. Let's compare us to the rest of the world. That's not the benchmark anyway. The benchmark is compare ourselves to the best we can do here, not the best that, or the worst that exists in the world. Generally, I prefer to be positive than negative, but I do think there are a number of things going on in the governance world that aren't going to get changed if they can be papered over.
Okay, so we're getting near the end. Have I missed? Yes, there. And let me know if I missed anyone. Yep.
Professor, following on slightly from a question behind me, perhaps we could lighten the load on board some ways. ESG, environment, social governance, toss the whole lot out, throw it away, load of claptrap. It will be too easy to crucify individual executives and companies, whatever they do, too easy to crucify them on the grounds of hypocrisy. Your comments, please.
Well, I think when this opens up, there's multiple agendas. I mean, some of the early stuff that was done in the UK, arguing very strongly for ESG and taking these social issues into account, really ran afoul of the question, well, okay, let's assume we wanted to do it. How do we do it? How do you balance an employee interest if you close a plant? How do you balance that with a shareholder's interest in terms of dividends or return? How do you balance spending more money on environmental issues at a particular plant with alternatively building a new plant and creating employment? There's a lot of what you technically refer to as crap that goes on. It sort of opens the door, and some people think the company is there to fix these social goals. But what I talked about earlier is that's not my view. The company's there to do a good job for the company, but doing a good job for the company will from time to time, and maybe for a long time, require a cognizance and a recognition of the need to accommodate interests that, if they're ignored and get stronger and stronger, do you much more damage.
Before I call, have I missed anyone? Okay, so final question.
Going back to Janet's question about people on boards and who should be on boards, it seems that boards are in trouble as far away as sport, football clubs. Is there just too much pressure on what is expected of a board? After all, they're only a board, they're not the chief executive. And are we really not looking at who should be on boards with particular emphasis on the kind of industry that they're on the board with?
The kind of inventory.
Well, in other words, set if you're skills. On a sporting board, you're yes. not the same sort of expertise as if you're on the bank board. I mean, there seems to be a mismatch between those, in many cases, that are on boards with the enterprise they're meant to be looking after.
Yeah. It's quite a good friend of mine became a chairman of a sporting board, one of the league franchises. And we was talking about the book and where we're at. He said, we need that book more than listed companies. we might follow that up. But I think one of the things that was interesting is the more you get into this, the more you realise it's not just a board of a money-earning company that has these problems. Whenever you use governance as the vehicle for getting a balance between the people with a stake in the activity and the people who run it, whenever you need to look at that balance, you're dealing with governance. And I mean, we see it in public companies. I served as at Pacific Power, where we weren't really running electricity, but we were quite heavily involved in governance.
Many thanks, Fred.
Thank you. Well, Rotel was right, it was 30 years since the first edition of Strictly Boardroom, and then there was another one not long after. And since then, Fred Hilmer's continued through with this work, and among many other things. And tonight, with What's Wrong with Boards, Rethinking Corporate Governance. And as I said, Fred will sign some books for those here tonight, and for those who are watching in other ways by Zoom or later on television. But for tonight, thanks for expressing your views very clearly, for engaging with us all. It was a very interesting night, and we've benefited from it, and good luck for the future, and well done.